Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we are recording the oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. This oral history focuses on memories from the October 1989 riot at the State Correctional Institution at Camp Hill. Our guest today, September 17, 2019, is J.D. Shutt. Thanks for joining us, J.D.
Thank you.
Before we begin, could you please provide us with a brief overview of your DOC career?
Sure. I started with the Department of Corrections as a trainee at FCI Graterford in April of 1977. While I was there, I achieved the rank of sergeant. And then in 1985, I got a promotional transfer to FCI Frackville. And I stayed there until 1989, when I interviewed for a position at Central Office of Training Division as the training lieutenant for the department to develop their new correctional officer trainee on-the-job training program.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed there until April of 1990, and then I became the chief of security for the state. Because in October, when the riot occurred, we had to transfer a bunch of inmates because of cell damage at the institution. And Greg White, who was the chief of security at the time, was transferred to what became SCI Waymore as a deputy superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was in the end of October or beginning of November, they appointed me as the acting chief of security.
Okay.
They made me the acting chief of security.
Mm-hmm.
And then in April of the following year, they made me the chief of security for the state. And I stayed in that position until I went to, and while I was there, I went from a lieutenant to the rank of major.
Right.
And then I got transferred to SCI Cole Township as a deputy superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there until it was 1995-96. And then I was transferred back to central office, where I became the assistant to the executive deputy secretary, which was at the time was Ray Clymer.
Okay.
I held that position for a while, and then they decided that they needed to create a policy office. So they created the Office for Standards and Practices and Accreditation, and they made me the chief of that division.
Right.
Then, while I was in that position, the chief of security was getting promoted or retiring or whatever, I forget. And I got called in, and they told me that they were now going to create a new bureau, standards, practices, accreditation, and security, and that I was going to be the director of that bureau and run the policy office and the security office.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed there until 2003, I think it was, and then I was transferred to SCI Frackville as a deputy superintendent, and I stayed there until I retired.
And when did you retire?
When did I retire? 2006? 2000, I think it was 2006.
Okay. Wow. That's right. I forgot that part about the chief of security and the policy office together. That was down at Utley Drive.
Yeah, that was down at I guess it would be at Utley Drive down or off of Slate Hill Road.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. So let's go to the riot. It is about 2:33 p.m. on Wednesday, October 25th, 1989. Where are you and what is happening?
Well, I'm in my office over at Utley Drive, and I looked out the window, and I saw this large plume of smoke coming up from, looked like it was the direction of the institution. So So I grabbed the phone and I called over, and they transferred me into, I asked for the captain's office, and they transferred me right in. And I can't remember what captain answered the phone, but he answered the phone, and I said to him, "Hey, Cap, you know, this is JD, are you all right over there?" And he says, "Well, like, F no, we're not all right. They're trying to take over the jail." And I said, "On my way." I hung up the phone, I grabbed my hat, and out I went and jumped in my car. And I went over, and I pulled up in the front of the central office. And, there was somebody at the front door, and they yelled at me, and they said, "JD, back gate." I took my car, and I drove immediately around to the back gate. Now, if we could back up here a little bit, the reason that the captain knew me was when I got transferred to SCI Frackville as a lieutenant, we had our transfers there that we could get in because 10% of your staff could be transfers and everybody else had to be new hires. Mm-hmm. And we had all our people hired and they all reported to the institution, but we had construction delays and we couldn't get any inmates in. So we had 117 brand new trainees. Nobody knew what to do with them. So the department decided to take the group of trainees and split them into two groups, sending half of them to Dallas and half of them to Camp Hill. And they took the commissioned officers at Frackville and they did the same thing with us. And I got assigned to supervision of the guys down at Camp Hill. Okay. And we were down there for 2 or 3 months. So in the time that I was down there, I became familiar with the institution because we had officers working everywhere on 6-2 and 2-10 shifts. They didn't work the night shift. And I got to know the institution. I got to know the staff, especially, you know, the commissioned officer staff and the higher-ups, because being a lieutenant, you know, I interacted with them, and I had to let them know what I was doing and where I was going. So when I called and I said, "Hey, this is JD," they knew who I was because I had been down there with these folks for, like, 3 months.
Right.
So anyway, I pull up by the back gate, park my car, and I go in, and the gate's partially open, and I went in, and I went over to the sally port, and I picked up the phone. I called into the captain's office, and I said, this is JD, shut up, you know, told Cap I was responding, I'm at the sally port, you know, what are my orders? And there was a pause. I could hear, like, some talking in the background and whatnot, and whoever answered the phone turned around and said, "Cap said just take charge of that area down there, JD." And I said 10-4, and that was that. Well, the EMS had started to respond, and they had the gate open, and they were coming in. So I cleared the sally port and told everybody, you know, nobody comes in, you know, without authorization, because we didn't need the confusion back there. Mm-hmm. And then it was just sort of a waiting game type thing. Well, a little bit later, I look up, and in walks this guy in a suit and this police officer, and apparently the guy up in the tower recognized him. And it was Mayor Stephen Reed.
Oh.
And the chief of police, I think his name was Whitlock or something like that back at the time. And I walked into the sally port, and I looked up at him, and Mayor Reed looks at me, and he says, "I'm Mayor Stephen Reed, this is Chief Whitlock." He says, "I want to go to the command post." And I said to him, "Well, you do you?" And he said, "Yes, I want to go to the command post." He said, "Right now." And I said, "Well, that decision is up to the command post. You know, hold on, I'll let them know you're here." So I called the command post and I said, "Hey, you know," I explained to him what happened. And they said, "Well, let me double check whatnot, JD, we'll get back to you." I said, "Okay." I told the mayor, I said, "There, you know, command post has been notified. When I find out, I'll let you know." So I don't know, like 5 or 10 minutes went by, and he comes over to the desk again, and he says, "Lieutenant, you know, I want to go to the command post now." And I said, "Well, they haven't called me back." I said, "But I'll tell you what," I said, "you know, I really don't want to be bothering them over there, but, you know, I will call again." So I called again, and I said, "Hey, the mayor's still here, and he's, like, demanding to come to the command post. You know, what do you want me to tell him?" And they said, "Hang on." There was, you know, a delay. And whoever it was came back on and said, "JD, you know, his request is denied." And I said, "Okay." And they said, "Well, hang on a second. We'll double check." said, okay. So I told them, I said, you know, hang on. Wasn't a hot 2 minutes later, they said, no, he can't. He's not authorized to come up here. I said, okay. And I looked at the mayor, and I was sitting at the desk. He was standing on the other side. And he looked at me, and he says, you know, Lieutenant, I want to go to the command post. And I stood up, and I looked at him. I said, your request has been denied. He said, what? I said, your request has been denied. Now get the hell out of my Sally port.
Now, JD, let me stop you here just for a second. Can you explain how tall you are? So when you stood up, what kind of a presence you gave to the mayor?
Well, I'm just shy at 6'5". In my recollection of him, he was about maybe 5'7". So I stood up, and I was sort of like looking down at him when I said to him, your request has been denied. Now get the hell out of my Sally port.
And what did he say?
And he just looked at me, and he looked at Chief Whitlock, and Chief Whitlock looked at me, and I looked at him, and he looked at the mayor and said, let's go. And they turned around, and they walked out.
Wow.
So I walked outside, and I motioned to the guy up in the tower that controlled the outer gate. You know, held my hands like 3 feet apart to tell him open the gate a little bit. And they walked out, and I told him close the gate. So what I was doing the whole time I was back there then is we had a whole lot of EMS showing up. There were fire trucks and ambulances and, you know, paramedic units and whatnot, all lining up outside the back gate. So I was trying to keep track of who was responding in case we needed them, you know, to respond inside. And I remember somebody came in to the Sally port. Somebody I knew, but I can't remember who he was. It was an officer down there. He came to the Sally port, and he said, hey, JD. And I said, what? And he said, there's inmates walking down the road to the Sally port. I said, what? And I went out, and I looked up the road that went up along, like, the back of the institution. And these two inmates were walking down, and they had two tradesmen with them in the khakis. And they came walking down, and they stopped about, I don't know, maybe 40 yards, 30, 40 yards from the Sallyport gate, and they just stopped. And the two tradesmen were the two inmates were on the outside, the two tradesmen on the inside, and they just stopped. So I looked up at them, I put my hands out, and I just yelled up to them, I said, you know, what? And the one inmate, who looked rather familiar to me for some reason, He looked and he said, we want to let these two go. And I said, okay. And they said, no, we want to let them go. And I yelled back up to the inmates and I said, fine, let them go. And the two tradesmen started walking to the back gate. The two inmates turned around and walked back up into the institution. So they walked out to the gate and I motioned to open the gate, let them in. And while all this was going on, I had turned to somebody and I said, you know, get EMS in here. Because I didn't know if these guys, you know, were injured or, you know, I didn't know what was going on with these two. So while this conversation was going on, they left in some EMS guys and they had two stretchers there. And I took motion to open up the inner gate. The two tradesmen came down. They walked through the gate. I closed the gate, and I told them, you know, on the stretchers. And they said, well, you know, we're okay. I said, on the stretchers. And they went, and then there was somebody at the back gate, another EMS responder, and the officer was going to open a gate, and I yelled, stop, because I was familiar with a lot of the corrections officers that were there, but I wasn't familiar with all of the tradesmen. And I didn't know, even though they were, you know, they were two Caucasian tradesmen. I didn't know if they were actually tradesmen or did the inmates, you know, the two inmates take their uniform and put their clothes on to try to, you know, get out. I didn't know them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I yelled up to the tower. I said, you know, keep the gate closed till these guys are identified. And one of the officers that was back there came over and said, JD, that's, you know, that's so-and-so, that's so-and-so. They are tradesmen.
Wow.
I said, I said, okay, fine. And then I said to the EMS, get these guys checked out for injuries. And they said, okay. And, you know, they took them out the gate, out to their vehicles outside. And for the rest of the day, it was fairly quiet back there. There was nothing going on. And then later on, I got a call, and they said, you know, JD, like, secure that area. And they were going to send somebody else down, and they said, come over to the captain's office. And I thought, well, you know, this is a good thing, you know. And I went over to the captain's office.
And where was the captain's office located?
Well, that was the captain's office right in Group 1.
Okay.
You know. So we went over there, and they had the captain's office. There was another, like, an outer office there where the clerical people were and whatnot. And it was late now. I mean, it was dark outside. And we were sitting there and sort of like recapping, you know, what had gone on, and people were talking about, you know, yeah, well, I was here and I was there, you know, telling them what had happened. And I remember a call came in. I was sitting there, I was talking to Steve Sunday, who at the time was a lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, I think he ended up being a major over there.
Right.
And we were talking, because Steve and I had known each other from when I was down there, and a call came in that an inmate had got out of his cell over in Group 2 and 3. I looked at Steve, and Steve looked at me, and we both got up, and Steve says, what? And I said, well, you or me? And he said, I'll get this one, you get the next one. He said, okay. And off Steve went. He wasn't gone very long. He came back, and I said, what happened? And he said, by the time I get over there, he said, the guy was back in the cell, and the officer really wasn't sure what cell he came out of. And I said, okay, because they had done damage to the locking mechanisms over there in the cells. So they were popping their cell doors open from inside the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve and I were sitting there talking, and we said, well, you know, this is not good. And we started kicking around ideas, like, what could we do? And I said, well, maybe we could get some chain and, you know, put chain around and put padlocks on. But already, at this point, I think it's closer to, it's pushing midnight. And it's like, where are we going to get, you know, chains and padlocks, that many at that time of night? So as we were talking, we said, well, you know, I looked at Steve and I said, well, you know, you have the RERP supplies here. I said, and in there, you have to have handcuffs for all the inmates. He said, yeah. And the way that those old cells were constructed, they're not like the new ones. If you remember, they were a bar construction.
Yeah.
And when the cell door opened, it passed in front of the bars, and then it came back and sort of aligned the frame of the door lined up with the frame of the door itself, like the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to Steve, I said, what if we got the RERP handcuffs? We went down there and we just put handcuffs on all of the doors. That would stop them from opening them. And somebody said, well, what if they have handcuff keys? I said, well, the officers aren't supposed to be carrying them. I said, but if they did get one or two, you know, and like Steve says, well, hell, by the time they would, you know, one guy would get out, he would go to another cell to try to get more inmates out, we'd already have somebody down there. We said, yeah. So Steve says, okay. He said, JD, I'm going to get a hold of the command post. And I said, all right, fine. We sat there. It was about, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes later, and Steve came in, sat down and looked at me, and I said, well, and he shook his head, and he said, nope. I said, what do you mean, no? And he said, command post said it's not necessary. You know, the riot's over. And that's the saddest part about this for me, because they had the incident that day. The institution had taken control back. All the inmates were in their cells. And Freeman and R.C. Smith, in their infinite wisdom, said, well, no, it's over, don't worry about it. And they misjudged the situation, because it wasn't over, it was halftime. And the next day, they came back out. They took over. They took the hostages.
So did you get to go home that late? Well, let's see, that would be, you said that was around midnight, so after midnight, yeah. Early morning Thursday, yeah. Did you go home?
Oh, I stayed until the next morning. I think it was about 6 o'clock or so. I left because we were waiting to see, you know, Steve and I, if there was any more incidents there, and then I went home.
Okay.
I got some sleep. I woke up, and we were living in Pine Grove at the time. Shelley was home, and I woke up, and I said to her, you know, wow, what a night. I said, you know, I'm really glad that, you know, it worked out. And she looked at me and she said, it didn't. I said, what do you mean? She says, the inmates went off. They had the jail. And I was just, I mean, thinking back on it, Sue, you know, it was just, I don't know. It was devastating to me because, you know, it was like we had weathered the storm the day before, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And to hear that, it was like, oh, no.
And
so I got dressed right away.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, the second day could have been prevented, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it, when they said it was over, I mean, all the activity was over, but, you know, they knew that there was damage to the locking mechanisms, and that was the key to the whole thing. And, you know, they were given a suggestion on, you know, we had all the hacks because they were all in the RERP, you know, the Radiological Emergency Response Plan,
mm-hmm.
you know, because of Three Mile Island down there.
Right.
You had to have all that equipment, you know, so we had what we needed. It was just a matter of going down and, you know, start slapping handcuffs on cells. So anyway, I got dressed, I got my car, and I went down, and I went right to central office, and Ray Clymer was, at that time, he was down there because I believe he was the regional deputy commissioner at that point.
Actually, he was the superintendent at Frackville, and
he was at Frackville.
Yeah, and he said he was on his way back from, they were at the warden's conference, he heard that this was happening, and he drove straight back from the warden's conference to the central office to offer his assistance.
Right, and I got there, and I remember Ray was there, and I think Doremus was the number two guy, and
yep.
Owens was the commissioner.
Yep.
And all it was then is, you know, the damage that was done. There was a fire here and a fire there. The kitchen was on fire, and then one of the cell blocks was on fire, and. You know, it was just a matter of, well, how are the state police going to respond at that point? Because the state police were there, they were, you know, because at the time, the way the policies and all were set up is you had an incident like that, and it was up, you know, the state police were the ones that were going to go in and regain control. They were going to be the front runners.
Okay.
That's how their policy was, and that's how the agreement was with the state police at that time. It was later changed when I was the chief security and I was there. I think that was Marty Horn wanted it changed.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, we ended up changing it. So, you know, we tried to offer what support we could, you know, from a central office perspective. And I remember at one point when they said that they were going to go in, they were going to take it back. They had formulated their plan and the state police were going to do their thing. When they started, we were upstairs in it would be the executive deputy secretary's office, because you could look out the window. We were in one of those offices up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I think it was Doremus had turned, and he looked at me and he said, well, Lieutenant, what do you think? And I said, well, they're going to come through, I think it was gate two, they used to call it. They said, they're going to come through there. I said, my guess would be, I said, any of the hostages that they have now, that they have that aren't injured or aren't hurt bad, I said, they're going to come out in the first group out of, I think it was on the looking at it down from the office, from central office on the left-hand side, the three housing units that were there, I think it was HI and J blocks. And I can't remember if it goes HIJ
it was
from right
H-
to left or left.
HJK on the left.
Okay. All right, HJK. And I said to him, well, if anybody that's not hurt real bad, they'll come out of, I said, the closest one to the gate. I said, the reason they're going to do that is if they send them out and the staff see that their staff members coming out, and if they're coming out under their own power, I said, it's going to have a positive impact on them that things are good. I said, also going to say any of the bad actors in there, they're going to come out with that group because they're going to want to get the hell out of there. And I said, anybody that's injured or hurt bad will be in the farthest housing unit from that gate, because they're going to want them guys filed last, because they're going to, the inmates are going to want to get out of there before they find anybody hurt real bad, and then, you know, it can really turn bad on the inmates. And Doremus just sort of looked at me, and he said, you think? And I said, well, yeah, that's my opinion, boss, you know. So when the state police came in, the inmates started surrendering out of H block. And they came out, and there was some that had, they had blankets and whatnot, like over their heads and whatnot, because I guess they didn't know how the force coming in was going to respond and whatnot. And they came out, and then you could see where it looked like they had separated one or two people from like the other group, and they were some of the staff members that came out. And then they went in, they started going into the housing units, and when they got into the last one, the farthest one from the gate, K block, I guess that was, you could see a difference in the activity out in front of the cell block, and the next thing you know, they started bringing in, they brought in some EMS people. And I looked at Ray and I said, you know, that's probably where you're injured. And I mean, in between there was some things that had happened that I am not going to speak to it, because my memory with that is like really kind of fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm trying to just remember what sticks out more clearly to me after all these years.
Right.
So then they had taken over the institution. They had taken the institution back. And I remember the first day afterwards, I went in, and I had called down the training academy, and I said, you know, I talked to Bill Sprinkle, and because technically I work for him. And I said, I'm reporting to the institution. I said, they probably need to help. And he said, yeah, do that. So I went to the institution, and I went into the captain's office, and Bob Stottlemyre was in there. And he was a shift commander that day. And I went in, and let him know I was there. And Bob, being typical Bob, turned around, and he said, are you here to observe for central office, or are you here to work? And I said, I'm here to do whatever you need me to do, Captain. And he said, good. He said, get over to group 2 and 3. He said, get a handle on that, he said, before it really gets bad. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you'll see when you get there. So I went over, and the state police were there. And we had staff in there that were searching housing units and searching inmates and whatnot. And as soon as you walked over and you got in between those housing units, you could just feel the tension. You could just, I mean, it just gripped you from the time you walked over. And I walked over, and one of the lieutenants was there, and I said, I said, good morning, I said, what's going on? And he just looked at me, and he pointed to, I guess it was K block, where the hostages had been. And I walked up, and I went in there, and there were officers in there searching inmates. And what they were doing is they were bringing them out of the cells. They were having them stripped. They brought them out of the cells, and then they put them, they were having them stand with their noses up against the wall by the cells. And as I walked down the housing unit, and I'm just going to tell you the truth on what I saw.
Okay.
And as I walked down, the inmate came out, and I said to him, put your nose against the wall. And the inmate stood at the wall, and he turned, and the officer said, I told you, nose against the wall. And he grabbed him by the back of the head and, like, bounced his head off the wall. And all I saw was this trickle of blood coming down the wall. So I went down, and I said, that's it, stop. And they said, what? I said, I'm giving you a direct order, stop. Put that inmate back in that cell and get out. He said, what? I said, we're calling a timeout. We're calling a timeout. And they put him back in the cell, and I yelled in the cell block. I said, you know, everybody, security inmates back in the cell, take it outside. We're taking a break. Go have a coffee. You know, we'll pick this up in 10 or 15. I need two officers to stay here for security. And everybody went out, and then I went, and I called Stoudemire, and I said, I just called a timeout over here. He said, things need to calm down. And he said, okay. And I said, and you better get, I said, somebody from medical over here, check this inmate out. You know, because he, you know, I don't know how bad he's hurt. And he said, okay, J.D. And I went over, and then I walked to the other housing units, because word travels fast, you know.
Right.
And I walked into the housing units, and, you know, I went in, and I said, how's things going? And, you know, I was talking to the guys, and I said, hey, look, you know, let's be professional about all this. Now, the inmates over on the other side of group 2 and 3, I remember there was two inmates in every cell over there, and they were handcuffing them and leg iron together. Mm. And I went down, and I walked down, and I came back, and I remember seeing two state troopers come out of the cell and hot-footed out of the housing unit. And this was never really revealed to anybody, really. And I went over to the cell, and this inmate's laying on the ground in the cell, and I looked at the guy who was handcuffed and leg ironed to. And I said, what's up? And they looked at me, and they said, what? He said, the inmate, I think it was another guy that I had recognized from when I was working there. And he said, they tuned him up pretty good. And I went out to the, I went outside, and the two troopers were talking with the, this was a captain or whatever, and I went over, and I confronted him about it. And the one trooper said, well, you don't understand that guy. I guess he had molested a child in this trooper's neighborhood. And I said, oh, so that gives you, by so what, just the right to go in there and just tune this dude up? And I looked at the captain, and I said, the guy appears to be hurt. I said, we better get him checked out. And they had the hospital staff came over, and from what I heard later is they transported him out of the institution. They took him to Holy Spirit Hospital, and they ended up doing surgery on him because he had a ruptured spleen.
Oh, my.
So I spent the whole first day basically over there supervising the surgery at these housing units. And I was there. I got there like at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I think I was there till, I think I didn't get home till like 1 o'clock in the morning. Mm. And then I went back down, and Cheryl just said that, you know, I got some sleep, I got up, took a shower, got dressed, I went back down at 8 o'clock the next morning.
Wow.
So when I got down there the next morning, I went in, and again, Stoudemire was there. And I went in, and I said, oh, what do you need me to do today, boss? And he said, go over. He said, we're setting up a command post, a group 2 and 3 field command post in the kitchen. I said, okay. He said, go over there. He said, handle that one, will you? And I said, yes, sir. You know, off I went. I said, is there a log book over there? And he said, yeah, we sent one down. I said, okay. And off I went. So I went over to the command post, and I got a status update, and they said that the inmates, they were just finishing up. I think they were just finishing up feeding them at that point, you know, because it takes a while, and they were just taking, I think, bags down and giving the inmates, you know, bags and a carton of milk or something like that. And I got an update on what was going on, and then they said that they were making arrangements to send inmates to different facilities. because there was so much damage done to the housing units over there and the locking mechanisms that they had to get inmates out of the institution so they could have the cells to effect repairs. And I said, you know, okay. And so for that, I ran that command post from 8 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night every day for the next 5 days.
Wow.
And during that time, what we did was, I believe Mike Leidy was with me, and we were identifying inmates. Like, they would tell us who they wanted to ship, what buses they were on, and then we would identify their locations in group two and group three, what cells these inmates were in, because, I had all the officers make up rosters of all the inmates that they had, because the inmates didn't get put back where they were supposed to get put back.
Right.
You know, when you have an incident like that, you know, this cell has one in, the next cell next to it has five in, because you're just trying to get people under control. So they would say, you know, they had a bus and it held X amount of inmates, and, you know, these are the ones we want. And then I'd sit there and go through all of the rosters and whatnot and find out where these guys were, and we'd get them, you know, we'd get them searched, handcuffed, and, you know, take them to the buses, and the buses would take them wherever they were going. And in the meantime, there was a lot of things that went on. It's like, you know, you're trying to feed these guys, they're handcuffed together, they're leg ironed together, and when they search the cell, normally when you have an incident like that, they start searching cells, they just empty. Personal property, institution property, you name it, it comes out. It ends up just being like a sterile environment. There's nothing in there but the convict. Most of the time, they're bare-ass naked. So they're feeding these guys, and of course now these people are eating. They need to use the facilities. Well, they didn't have anything. You know, they didn't have toilet paper and cells. So I called over to the command post and I said, you know, hey, we got to get some toilet paper and some stuff over here in cells. And, you know, the answer that I got back was, well, if they need it, they can ask, and then, you know, we'll let them use what they need and we'll get it back. And I said, what sense does that make? And they said, well, we don't want any more fires. They were afraid they were going to set the toilet paper on fire. And I said to them, well, you know, if the officers did their job and they searched these guys, nobody should have any matches or lighters left. Now, my recommendation is you get cases of toilet paper over here and you put one in every cell and take that, you know, or do you want to have your officers running back being a valet here for these guys? So they said, well, we'll get back to you. And then it was about 15 minutes later. They said, JD, you know, they're sending this stuff over. You know, I put it in a logbook. That, you know, toilet paper being, you know, being dispensed to, you know, to all cells. And everything that happened over there, everything, you know, if we did a meal, it got logged. You know, if the command post called and said, you know, well, we want this, that, or the other thing, it got logged. You know, who gave the order, you know, what time it was, everything was logged. Because having been a ship commander, you know, I knew how that worked, you know.
Right.
So, because I know at one point we get a call, and there's a command post, and they said, JD, and I said, yes, and they said, be advised that Deputy Smith has ordered mace to be distributed to all officers on housing units. And I was stunned. I said, I beg your pardon? They said, Deputy Smith has ordered mace to be issued to all officers on housing units. And I said, well, you know, I understand the order. I said, but, you know, be advised that, in the state of Pennsylvania, you know, mace, the use of mace is considered the use of deadly force. So pulling that mace canister out and squirting that inmate with the mace is the same thing as you pulling a handgun out and firing a handgun. Because mace, back in the day, they said it was made with it had a kerosene base, and it could cause lung injuries, and anybody that was asthmatic or anything like that, it could be life-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And they had deemed it lethal force. And I said, so, you know, I'll do, you know, if they issue it, they get it down there, we'll get it issued, but, you know, be advised that, you know, it's lethal force. And they said, you know, duly noted, and click, They hung up. So I put it in a logbook, you know, as per Deputy Smith, you know, makes to the issue to all officers assigned housing units. Well, it wasn't a hot 5 minutes later. The phone rang. It was the same person that called before. They said, J.D., and I said, yeah, and they said, that order's been rescinded. There'll be no mace. I said, you know, 10-4. I said, you know, between you, you know, you mean lamppost. And good decision. Hung up the phone, and I put it in a logbook, you know. As per Deputy Smith, you know, the order to issue mace has been rescinded, and I put the time in there. And I did that for 5 days. Everything that happened for 5 days.
Wow.
And then when they no longer needed me to do that, you know, it was Captain Tsai and Bob Stottlemyre. I went over and I said, now what? And they said, well, you know, JD, you know, thanks for everything you did. You know, we know where you're at. You're only a mile away. If we need you, we'll call. I said 10-4, and off I went. I went back to doing my thing, you know, to training camp.
Wow.
And then,
go ahead.
Well, they, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Now you go.
Afterwards, you know, they were doing this investigation. And I believe it was the Inspector General's office was involved in that, if I recall. Am I right?
I think so, yeah.
Because I remember I was down at the training academy, and somebody came to my door and said, you know, stop, just, whoever this guy was, he was a soup, you know, said, you know, he wants to talk to you. And I said, you know, okay. And the guy came in, and he identified himself as, I don't remember what his name was, but he said, you know, I'm with the Inspector General's office. And I said, you know, okay, what can I do for you? And he said, well, I'd like to talk to you about, you know, the incident over at Camp Hill. And I asked the obvious question. I said, you know, has this all been cleared through, you know, the central office? And he, you know, looked at me and said, yeah, well, I wouldn't be here if they wouldn't let me. And I said, you know, good point. And I said, you know, what can I do for you? And he asked me, like, about three questions. Well, he asked me the first question. It was about something when I was running the command post, and he asked me something, and I looked at him, and I said, yeah, that's what happened. I said, it's in the logbook. And he gave me this strange look, and he had a notepad, and he made a note. And he asked me the second question, and I sort of, like, shook my head, and I said, yeah, that too. Yes, that did happen, and yes, that is in the log. That's in the logbook also. And he gave me this look again, and he asked me a third question, and he looked at me, and he said, Lieutenant, what logbook? And I said, it was the logbook at the kitchen command post. I said, everything I did for 5 days, I said, is annotated in that logbook. I said, all these questions that you're asking me, I said, that is all included in the logbook. And he looked at me and he said, I haven't seen a logbook. I said, well, you know, there's a logbook. And he said, well, before I ask you any more questions, he says, I'm going to go look for this logbook. And I said, fine, you know. It's like, this is my office, this is where I'm at, and off he went. Well, later on, he came back, and he said, you know, he said, Lieutenant, he said, do you know the whereabouts of that logbook? And I said, the last I saw the logbook, I said, it was a field command post logbook, it was supposed to be in a field command post, I said, and that's where I left it. I said, and every day I started that logbook, but they had somebody sitting over there sort of riding shotgun at it overnight, just in case something happened. I said, every day I went in there, I said, I put in there who I relieved, what time I relieved them, and when I left it that night, the last entry I made was who relieved me and what time I was leaving. I said, that command post was, I said, that logbook was for the command post, and that's where I left it. He said, well, we can't find it. And I said to him, well, all I can tell you is, you know, I don't have it. I left it in the command post. So then they were interviewing more people and whatnot, you know, and then this guy, they never came back to me. And I saw this guy one day in the hallway down there, over at central office, and I said, "Hey, how you doing?" And he said, "Okay." And I said, "You know, you never came back to talk to me." And he got this very strange look on his face. He looked at me and he said, "And I won't be back." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Oh, well, you're not to be interviewed." And I said, "What?" He said, "You're not to be interviewed." Just let it at that. And I was never interviewed by anybody.
Wow.
By the IG's office, by our department. I was never debriefed. I was never questioned by anybody. Anything that happened. So I went on with my career.
Wow.
But it can still bring me to tears knowing what those guys went through. And they didn't have to.
And
but
listening to you tell this, which I've never heard your story before, JD, so I just have to tell you, it's amazing. And you saw the worst in everybody. You saw the worst in the inmates as they rioted, and then afterwards you saw the worst in our staff and our PSP people as they were dealing with the aftermath. And you were like the voice of reason among all of these people who were tired and hot-headed and had been through this traumatic, shocking event. And there you are just trying to keep everybody honest, accountable.
Well, I just thought of, thank you. I just thought of something else. I remember the first day I went down to the command post, and they were still trying to make sure they had everybody. And I remember they had fires in the kitchen, and the fire marshal was there, and he came up. He came up to me and he said, "You know, he said, can I get some help here?" And I said, "What do you need?" He said, "Well, we're trying to search all of the areas that had fires in." I said, "Well, if you're looking for the cause of the fires," I said, that's your job, not mine. And he looked at me, he says, "No," he said, "we're not looking for that." I said, "We're looking for bodies." And I said, "What?" He said, "They're not sure they have all the inmates. They're looking for bodies." So I said, "Okay," and I looked around and I grabbed like one or two officers. I said, "You know, get some flashlights," and you know, there was nothing really going on there at that point. It was kind of calm. This was after the search and whatnot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting flashlights and taking these two officers, and we start going through the storerooms in the kitchen. And I remember walking into this one room, and in the corner, there was just this blob in the corner. And when I went in, it was like, you know, oh my God. So I went out and we got the fire marshal, and we went in. And I said, "I don't know what this is." And we went in, and he said, "You know, give me a minute." And he came out and he looked at me, and I said, "Well," he said, "No," he says, "that's chicken." And I said, "What?" He said, "They must have had cases of chicken parts there." He said, "On a rack." He said, "And it sort of like melted down." And I said, "Oh, thank God."
Huh.
And he looked at me and he says, "But that's what it would have looked like." He said, "That's what I want you to look for." And I went, "Gee, thanks, brother." And then we searched the whole kitchen area, and you know, we couldn't find anything. And then later on, I talked to the fire marshal, and he said, "No," he said, "everybody's accounted for." He said, "But, you know, thanks for the help." And I said, "Yeah, cool."
So there you are, searching, looking for a blob, chicken-like blob. I mean, that must have been awful, just to think, you know, when you turn the corner or when you flash your flashlight over there, oh God, what if I find one? That's awful.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. It's very sobering. Let's put it that way. I mean, you know, you're just, you know, it just twists your mind around, because, you know, maybe the fire marshals want out there, you know, they're used to responding to scenes of, you know, fires and residential fires and whatever, but for us, I mean, it was, you know, that's not something that, you know, wasn't our job description.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, it was, see, you know, to me, and I often said this, you know, everything I learned about dealing with inmates, I learned from Donald Vaughn.
Right.
And everything I ever learned about dealing with staff, I learned basically from Ray Clymer. And the three most influential people in my career were Ray Clymer, Donald Vaughn, and Chuck Zimmerman.
Mm-hmm.
They were my three go-to guys in my career. You know, later on, I had a pretty good relationship with Dr. Beard, a very honest relationship. But early on to my, let's say, my formative years, you know, they were the three.
Right.
And they were all men of really, if you knew them, high integrity. And they really wanted things done right. In the worst moment, the crazier shit got, the calmer he could become.
Wow.
And that's how I patterned my career.
Right.
And that's why when I walk into that situation at Camp Hill, and I see this inmate, you know, getting his forehead bounced off this concrete wall, it's like, no, it's wrong, because that's the type of stuff that comes back on the department. You know, well, that's why the inmates do this, because this is how they're treated. This is how they treat them afterwards. Well, that's how they treat them before.
Right.
But, I mean, it was as something that, you know, like I said, those 5 days, it was, well, and then I'll tell you something else that happened was, I had gone back to the training academy, and the next thing I know, they transferred Greg, so they said, you know, you're going to be the acting chief security. And I said, okay, and I was over in an office, in central office, and I get a phone call, and they said, let's see if I get this right now. They said it was some judge's office. And I said, what? And it was a judge from the middle district.
Mm-hmm.
That's where Camp Hill. And I said, yeah, right. And I put it through, and they put it through, and this woman came on the phone, and she says she was calling from Judge so-and-so's chambers or whatever, and that the judge would like to speak to you. And I said, okay. And this fellow got on the phone. He said to me, I have a question for you. And I said, you know, what's that? And then he said, are the inmates in Camp Hill still handcuffed together and still leg ironed together? And I said, as far as I know, yes, sir. And he said, why? And I said, with all due respect, Your Honor, you know, I think that's a question that you need to ask the people in charge of the institution. And he said, you know, are the cells secure? He said, as far as I know, yes, but again, that's a question that you should ask the institution. He said, I've already checked with the institution. I've been assured that the cell doors are secure, because I think they'd done something with change or whatever at that point. And he said, and I've been told that there's no reason to have those shackles on. And I said, well, again, sir, you know, that wasn't my decision. And, you know, he said, let me put it to you this way. He said, I want the handcuffs and the leg irons off those inmates. I want them off those inmates in 24 hours. Or I was a lieutenant. He said, "Well, Lieutenant," he said, "I will hold you in contempt of my court. Have a good day." So I went up to the third floor, and I said, "Hey, unless you want this Polish boy in the, you know, in a county prison, this is what happened." And I said, "What do we, you know, I'm turning it over to you guys, you know." And they said, "We'll get back to you." And I said, "Okay, fine." And it was a little while later they came back and they said that, you know, they were making all the arrangements to have the handcuffs and the leg irons removed.
Wow.
And I said, "Thank you." And I made a phone call and I said, "It's in process now." I talked to this woman. I said, I asked for the judge and she said he was in session at that point or something. And I said, "Well, would you let His Honor know that they're in the process of making that happen? And I have no time frame to share on how long it'll take, but it is in process now. And, would you please let him know that?" And she said she would. That's the last I heard of that.
It's just amazing to me to think that the judge called you. Like, why wouldn't he reach out to the chief counsel's office or to the commissioner's office? How did he even find you? That's interesting.
I don't know, because the only thing that kept going back to my mind was, having run that command post for 5 days, did somebody turn around and say, "Well, yeah, well, they were handcuffed and all that because, J.D., said." I could never connect those dots.
Yeah. Or maybe he just figured you're the chief of security, you're the one to talk to. It was funny.
I don't know.
Going back to you talking about that logbook, as you were talking about the different things that you were logging, I wrote down JD had a logbook for everything. And I was thinking, "Ooh, I'd love to get my hands on that logbook." Well, apparently other people wanted their hands on that logbook too, and it must not exist any longer.
Yeah, because like I said, when that guy from the ID's office, he's looking at me and he's like, "What logbook?" And
right.
I said, "Well, when you run a command post, you keep a logbook. I mean, every order that you're given, you log. Every order that you give, you log. Everything that happens of any kind of importance or any kind of pertinent information or event or whatever, you log."
Mm-hmm.
What happened, if it's an order you received, it's like, who gave you the order, what was the order, and what time did it happen, and then what did you do with it?
Yep.
And I said, that's something that you learn. I said, being down at Graterford, when I was down at Graterford, I mean, I started there in April of 77, and it was June of that year we had a kitchen steward killed over scrambled eggs.
Yeah.
And then in 1979, we had Captain Mokrzyczek was killed. And then in 81, we had the hostage situation. And then in 83, we had the riot on B Block. So, I had been, indoctrinated, and involved at different levels and doing different things with emergencies from early on in my career.
Yeah.
And, when you're, if you have any kind of conscience or any kind of, if you want to succeed or whatever, you learn from every event. And it was like when I said to this guy, "It's all in the logbook." He's like, "What logbook?" I'm like, "The logbook." And then he comes back later and says, "We can't find a logbook."
Mm.
And I'm like, "Well, do you have it?" "No, I don't have it. I left it in a command." So, there was some talk that it's like, because I had asked, like, how come, because I remember, with Steve, I think with Steve Sunday, we were talking, and he said, "Well, JD, so when they interview you," because from what I remember, Steve was going to tell them about our conversation with these handcuffs for trying to secure the cells. And I said, "Well, don't worry. I mean, it was me and you, And... if you tell them I got your back because, like this, I'm going to tell them, and I expect you to have my back because this should have never happened."
Right.
it was everybody just wanted it over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Freeman and R.C. Smith and Doremus and, you know, and Owens. None of them, I know R.C. Smith and Freeman, you know, had never been involved in anything of this. I mean, that's the first time ever that, you know, in the history of corrections in Pennsylvania. We've been doing it longer than anybody when it goes all the way back to the Walnut Street Jail. You know, nobody's done corrections longer than we have, and that's the first time we ever lost an institution all the way to the fence.
Right.
And they just wanted it over, and it's like, well, it's quiet, you know, it's over. And they're saying, well, I'm glad, you know. You got guys coming out of their cells and we don't want them out. I mean, this is not a good thing.
Right.
But they just wanted it to be over, and they just wanted it behind them, and they, you know, they just wanted to say, well, we handled it. And unfortunately, some guys paid a real stiff price for that.
JD, I want to thank you so much for participating in this project.
Well, you're welcome.
Okay.